Good morning and welcome to Step Into the Light. We're your hosts. I'm Patty Sheen.
And I'm Jeanelle Theory. Thank you for listening.
Together, we will introduce you to people who have found their way out of the dark shadows of life and back to light.
And those who, through various ministries and creative endeavors, lead others on their journey from darkness to light. Good morning and welcome back. Our guest today, Karen Sargent, writes emotionally charged fiction with characters whose imperfect faith collides with real-life conflicts. In other words, grab a tissue. In addition to writing novels, she writes devotionals for various guidepost publications and is a frequent contributor to Chicken Soup for the Soul. A recently retired high school and college English teacher, Karen gets her teaching fix by presenting writing workshops at guilds, conferences, and coffee shops. Her passions are encouraging aspiring authors and launching books for published authors. She and her husband are adjusting to their empty nest in the beautiful Arcadia Valley. Good morning, Karen. Thank you for being with us.
Well, good morning, and thank you so much for inviting me.
Hi, Karen. This is Patty, and I also want to welcome you to the show.
Thank you, Patty.
I will get us started with our first question here. Karen, you've penned a considerable amount of writing across different mediums and genres. Tell us about your writing journey. Where did you get started in writing? And what is your favorite type of writing?
Well, I am very cliche, like many writers. I've always wanted to write ever since I was a child. One of my earliest memories is sitting at my mom's kitchen table with a crayon, pretending like I was writing before I could even spell words. And it's just something I've always felt drawn to. And so I did a little of it as a child and as a teenager. Then when I decided to choose a major in college, I decided to become an English teacher because I love to read and write. But what I quickly found out is as an English teacher, I didn't have time to read and write anything except for what I was working on for my students and in my classroom. Eventually, especially as my, I had two little girls, and raising girls also took away any writing time. And eventually they got old enough to where they didn't need me as much, and I could find little pockets of time, and I started my first novel, Waiting for Butterflies. And eventually, I got the idea for the book when my youngest daughter was 5 months old, and my book released the month before she graduated from high school. So I joke that I raised a book and a baby. But I've ended up just by God opening very unexpected doors, writing for Guidepost. I've written several devotions, and I'm working on a project for them right now. And I enjoy writing Chicken Soup for the Soul. It's just fun, and I like the smaller projects like that as opposed to writing a novel where it takes a long time to get the feeling of, I'm finished. But with Chicken Soup for the Soul, they have fun topics to write to, and the projects are quick. And so that's where I spend most of my writing time.
I was going to say, Karen, you've got a couple impressive feathers in your cap with Guideposts and Chicken Soup. Is it true that timing is everything, or it's who you know, or how did you get in there?
Well, for both of those publications, it truly was, I wouldn't even say timing. I would absolutely say God was just in the middle of both of those publications, but maybe timing as well. I just simply wrote, submitted, and doors just opened from there, and I've been very blessed in that respect. As a matter of fact, with Guidepost, it's kind of funny. I just had a conversation with the editor that I'm working with right now that I really never intended to be a devotional writer. I joke and say I'm not that holy, because I feel like there's a lot of pressure to really bring a good word in just a short amount of time. And I actually wrote an article thinking maybe I would submit it to Angels on Earth. That's one of their publications. And I actually wrote it about an experience we had during my husband's leukemia battle. and I just submitted it online, the editor responded, and she didn't reject it, but she said, we're going to add this to our inventory. And then a couple of months later, an editor of another one of their publications, which is Strength and Grace, it's a devotional for caregivers, she found out about the piece I had submitted and contacted me and said that perhaps I would have some valuable things that I could contribute to other caregivers and write for Strength and Grace. And that's actually how I got my foot in the door with Guidepost. And then from there, another editor contacted me and another. And I've been very, very blessed to be involved in several projects. And right now I'm writing for Mornings with Jesus 2023. So that's just something that God just opened a huge door and has, I would say, equipped me to do something that I didn't think I would be very good at, but he's really blessed me with some really good and patient editors who really helped draw the depth out of the stories that I'm telling in the devotionals. So I've been very blessed.
How wonderful. Thank you for sharing that.
Yes, that is very interesting. And I
thank you.
Jean, wasn't it you that sent me an email talking about different ideas that had been rejected time and time again, and wasn't Chicken Soup for the Soul one of them?
Yes,
and it's
absolutely.
Amazing now how it's amazing now how that series has taken off. I don't know how many. Oh my goodness, I want to say dozens. It's probably hundreds of books that Chicken Soup has put out.
Yes,
Chicken Soup puts out about 12 books a year. And they've been doing that for quite some time. So they do have many publications and many, many millions of readers.
Yes, definitely. And of course, Guidepost has been around for, oh my goodness, probably ever since I was younger.
Me too. Right. I remember as a young girl. Yes, me too.
I want to say Guidepost has been around for about 70 years, something like that. It's been a very, very long time.
Yeah, and I used to subscribe to Angels on Earth. I don't receive that magazine anymore, but I bought a subscription for my daughter for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And every year I ask her, do you still read these? Yes, I do, Mom. So I always renew the subscription. So that's a wonderful market to be a part of, because you just have so many readers and you have so much that you can share. So congratulations, Karen. That is a great story, and thank you, like Jean said, for sharing that with us.
Well, thank you.
Karen, you spent many years in teaching, and congratulations on your recent retirement. What did you love most about instructing students through the complexities of the English language?
The interesting thing, as much as I loved my content, I loved my students the most, and just being able to interact and try to be a positive role model for them. We live in a rural community, one of the poorest counties in our state, and there are just a lot of broken families, a lot of broken kids, and I was blessed to teach high school students. For 11 years, I taught freshmen, juniors, and seniors, and then my last 11 years, I taught seniors only. But to be able to let kids know somebody loves them, somebody cares about them, they are worthy, they can dream, they can accomplish dreams, and really to be able to equip them in the content that I taught to move beyond their circumstances and move beyond the lack of opportunity that our small town offered. And I was very, very committed to teaching my students to be able to write well, to be able to communicate well, to read in terms of comprehending depth, and just really equipping them. And most of the classes I taught were for college credit, actually, in the high school. So I really was able to set very high expectations for my students. But I loved scaffolding my instruction and their learning so that they could reach those expectations. It was just extremely rewarding to watch kids do things they didn't realize that they could do. And because they were seniors, those who would, about 40 to 50% would go to college, a junior college or a state college, and many of them would stay in touch, or I would run into their parents in the grocery store, or I would see them when they were home from college for a break, and to hear their success stories and that they felt equipped to do the things they were asked to do, if they had to write a paper, if they had to speak in front of a class, or any of those skills that we worked on. That was my very, very favorite part of teaching, is just building into the students, and my content was just kind of my vehicle to be able to do that.
What a fabulous message at any age. I mean, especially important for those seniors, but I feel like I could use that encouragement still.
Absolutely.
Thank you for what you have contributed to the teaching community and to our young people in general.
Well, thank you so very much. I retired with only 25 years. That was my first eligibility, and it was just, I felt I was supposed to retire. I was not burned out. I just had this feeling I was supposed to retire, and people would ask me, are you really retiring? And I would say, I think I am. And they'll be like, well, what are you going to do? And I'm like, I don't know, which for me was really odd, because I'm a little bit of a control freak. And for me not to have it all planned out was just such an odd feeling for me. And I would tell people, you know, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I know God has something for me. I can feel it, and I'm really pretty excited about it. Yes. And that was kind of how I walked into my retirement. And I actually had a couple of gigs lined out. The local university, which is about 70 miles from us, I was going to actually supervise student teachers for them and go out and see them in the field and evaluate them and help them while they were doing their student teaching in the different schools in the area. And I was going to continue teaching part-time for the junior college that I taught some night classes for. And that was kind of, I had those on the back burner to see, you know, God's going to have something for me, but, you know, these things have fallen in my lap, so I'll follow these. And he changed that plan very, very quickly. And so I think that's something that we'll be talking about today. That'll be our subject.
Great. Well, and it's interesting, too, how God works those plans, and they're all unique to all of us. I have a friend who is an instructor at the YMCA, and she's in her early 50s, and she's going to a private school to teach PE. And I went, wow, well, there's a career change in your 50s. You're going to a grade school. And she's like, yep. I go, how do you feel about that? She's like, I don't know, but that's what I'm supposed to do. And I went, okay, I hope you enjoy it. And you know, the whole journey, right? It's not just, okay, now I have a new job. It's just a transformation, and it sounds very similar to what you're describing, Karen. You know, you don't, might not know exactly what you're doing tomorrow, but you know you will when you get there.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So tell us about your book, Waiting for Butterflies.
Well, Waiting for Butterflies actually was inspired by a true event, which was the unexpected death of my mother-in-law. She was 61, and we received the middle-of-the-night phone call, and that nobody wants to receive. And at the time, my daughters were 5 months and 3 years old, and I called a friend and asked her if she could come and stay with the girls while we drove to about an hour to my father-in-law and to, you know, just be there with him. And when my friend came over, I told her, now the baby is not going to sleep through the night. She never has. And when she wakes up, this is what you do, and, you know, she will go back to sleep. So we were on our way, and when we returned the next afternoon, I was concerned about my friend. She was single. She didn't have children, and I just thought, oh, she's probably had a rough night. And when I asked her, well, how did everything go? She said, oh, everything was fine. The baby slept through the night. And I'm like, what? She has never slept through the night. And my friend even said, well, I slept on her bedroom floor because I was so afraid she'd wake up and I wouldn't hear her. So I thought, okay, well, way to go, little girl. You slept through the night. You picked a good night to do that. And so for the next 7 nights, she slept through the night. And my husband and I were lying in bed one night, and we hadn't fallen asleep yet. And I just happened to say, you know, ever since your mom passed, the baby has slept through the night. And he said, I know. because he gets kind of freaked out about things, and it was kind of, you're going, is there something going on here? So we laid there for a few minutes, and then he goes, Mom, if you're still here, we're okay. You can go now. And I am telling the honest truth, that baby woke up that night, and every night thereafter until she's probably 12 years old, she's 22 now, and she still is not a great sleeper. But it was a time, you know, and when I tell this story, I always say, I don't know what happened there. You know, maybe God just knew we needed to rest and he had our baby sleep, or maybe he had put an angel beside her crib. You know, I don't know what happened, but I do know for 7 solid nights she slept through the night, and then never again forever. It was one of those situations when I would wake up in the morning and she did sleep through the night when she was maybe 3, I would be in a panic because, she didn't wake up in the night, and I had to run in and check on her because she was such a terrible sleeper. So anyway, that all just gave me the idea for Waiting for Butterflies that what if a mom was taken from her family and she wasn't ready to go? Because my mother-in-law was not ready to go. She had 3 young granddaughters, all under the age of 3, and she was just not ready to go. And so that's where the idea for Waiting for Butterflies was born. So Maggie is the main character, and she's a mom who is a mom and a wife, tragically taken from her family. She's not ready to go, and she's allowed to linger with the family and kind of follow them through their aftermath and of her death, and make sure that they're all going to be okay. And so that's what Waiting for Butterflies is about.
Who is your target reader, and why should they be interested in it, Karen?
My target reader, age-wise, is probably early 30s, moms, older ladies, grandmothers, just those who, have the heart of understanding when you love people and you want to take care of them, and sometimes we're not able. And it's not because we're not physically present necessarily, but that's one thing I discovered as I was writing Maggie's character and the conflicts and what she was seeing happening to her family, that, as I raised 2 girls, as I've raised, putting quotes around that word, hundreds of high school students in my classroom, watching sometimes choices they make, influences that they're fighting against, bad influences, and sometimes just life that happens, that as a mother, sometimes there's really not much I can do about it. Sometimes there are just things that you watch happen and you're trying to support your child through, or as a teacher, a student through, or whatever. And that was one of the things that I felt like I related so strongly to Maggie about, because life is difficult when you're raising teenagers. We can be doing our best in our home as Christian parents and have our children in church, but that worldly influence is so strong, and the peers that they're in school with, and how they're treated and how they respond. There's just so much there that's beyond our control, and we have to do our best to navigate and see them through, and sometimes we feel like it's almost impossible. And so I think that is one of the reassurances that a mom and a sister, an aunt, a grandmother who would be reading my book would be able to relate to Maggie, but also to see that we get through those things. We get through those difficult times.
Absolutely.
Well, at this point, let's go to a break, and this is where I remind listeners that you are listening to Step Into the Light with hosts Jean Alfieri and Patty Sheen. And our guest today is Karen Sargent. Karen, oh my goodness, she has multiple devotionals in Guidepost Publications and in Chicken Soup for the Soul. She spent spent 25 years in the career of English, and we have talked about her writing journey. We've talked about her teaching. So as we progress, Karen has another major issue that she would like to discuss with us, and we'll get to that in a minute. In the meantime, if you would like to listen to the show again, or hopefully you will refer to friends and family, you can go to my website, which is pattysheene.com. That is spelled P-A-T-T-I-S-H-E-N-E. And there at the top of the page, you will find the Blog Talk Radio tab. Click on that, and you will find a list of all of our shows. Under Karen's show, under every show, there will be a more information tab, and that's where you will find a link to Karen's website and her social media. Karen, as you know, on this show, our premise is leading others out of darkness and back to light. We know that life isn't always rosy. It's not always, doesn't always go according to the plans that we have. You've clearly been blessed, as you discussed with us, about your teaching career and how much they meant to you, but you've also struggled with some very difficult times. So would you share with us a time when you journeyed from darkness to light?
I certainly will, and I alluded to this a moment ago when I was explaining that I knew I was supposed to retire at 25 years, even though it didn't really make sense. I knew that, and I felt like God had something for me. What I found out, and I kind of joke about this, was my husband was diagnosed with leukemia at the end of both of our careers, and he had retired March 1st of 2019, and on March 19th, he was diagnosed with leukemia, and so I finished out my last couple of months of teaching, and I also retired, and it was just so unexpected. And he had retired actually from 32 years in law enforcement. He retired as a state highway patrolman. And I just remember the feelings when we got to the emergency room at 2 o'clock in the morning. He was bleeding profusely from the mouth, which was just so bizarre. And we couldn't figure out, he couldn't get to stop. And we had done enough Google research that we had figured out this is what was happening, that he had leukemia. And prior to that, he had been suffering for about 7 weeks with bronchitis, respiratory infection. He'd gone through 2 rounds of medications and just was not getting well. And that night, before he went to the emergency room, we went to bed at 10:30 at night. He was asleep, and I had laid my hand on his chest right over his heart, and I just prayed so hard, God, heal him. Just heal him. I know you can. I know he can wake up in the morning and he can be well, because he was sick, and we just couldn't figure it out. And then at 1:30 that morning, so just a few hours later, the bathroom light was on, and he wasn't in bed, and it was very quiet, and I thought, what's happening? And I walked into the bathroom, and so he was bent over the sink, and I could see that he'd been bleeding, and he just looked at me and said, I'm in trouble. And I said, what is happening? And he handed me the iPad where he had already Googled, and all the symptoms were there, and I just read through the symptoms for leukemia, and he had every single symptom and had for weeks. We had just missed it. And so we went to the emergency room, walked in, and said, I think my husband's got leukemia. Within an hour, they confirmed, yes. They transported us to St. Louis, which Barnes Jewish Hospital, Siteman Cancer Center, is a major, major cancer center researcher in the Midwest. And after some genetic tests that afternoon, they came in and confirmed, this is the type of leukemia you have. And they still needed to do a few more tests before they could determine what chemotherapy to prescribe. But my husband asked the doctor, so this was on a Wednesday morning, and my husband asked the doctor, so will I be here through the weekend? And the doctor said, oh, no, you're going to be here for at least a month. And we were just floored because we'd had no experience at all with leukemia. And so that was Wednesday. By Saturday, the genetic testing was complete, and they began his chemo, which he was connected to an IV pole and received chemo 24 hours a day for 7 days straight, which just really blew my mind because, my mom had died from breast cancer, and, I know she would get her chemo every 3 or 4 weeks as her, body was able to take it and then go home, just you go in, get your chemo, go home. So this was just entirely just absolutely floored us, and I just remember thinking, I can't believe this is our story. I can't believe this is our story. And, you know, as I'd watched my husband just so sick and in a hospital bed, and I just kept thinking, all these years he, you know, wore his uniform and he had his body armor and he had his service weapon and everything to protect him. And we made it through that career, and now he days later, you know, here he is and his life is being threatened. And it was just the most bizarre feelings. But I was also so very grateful because I had 2 months to finish out school, but I had enough sick days, and my district was wonderful about giving me time that I needed to really all I had to do. My only concern was taking care of my husband. We didn't have to worry about paychecks and sick days because his pension was coming in. I had enough, you know, of my days that I still had my check coming in. So our only focus was getting him well. And so that was a tremendous blessing. He, after his 30 days, he did achieve remission, but they just, his doctor decided he needed to have a bone marrow transplant, and so our oldest daughter ended up being his donor. And so September 12th, he had his bone marrow transplant, and we're coming up on his two-year. They call it a new birthday because he's getting all this new bone marrow, and so you're brand new. And so his second new birthday will be next month. It's been quite a journey. It, you know, when you're battling cancer to that degree and the chemo he had, those 7 days, that was one round of chemo. He had 4 more rounds, 5 days each, and the toll it's taken on every system in his body has been incredible. I joke, I say he has all the ologists. He's got an ophthalmologist and a dermatologist and a cardiologist and all the ologists. Because every system in his body has been affected. Here he was, this tough, strong man, you know, and it's been very humbling for him. He's doing well, you know, physically he does anything he wants to now, but he's often very slow, usually gets at least one good nap in a day. And so there's been some limitations, and it certainly has changed what we thought our retirement would look like at this point. But that's all the... That's not all the yuck. That is the surface. We went through some really very hard times. I do remember one specific, but, I mean, it's many specific times in the hospital. He had the particular chemo they gave him. He had a reaction to the chemo, but it took his third treatment. So his third time in the hospital, which he was in the hospital 93 days in 2019 from March till December. So it took our third time in the hospital with him getting a treatment for the doctors to realize that he was reacting to the chemo and his particular reaction. They finally did some research and found that there were 8 documented cases in the world of people reacting to the chemo the way he did. It was just pretty intense. And I remember one morning I don't know why I was awake. It was about 1 in the morning, but of course, you wake up off and on, and that was one huge blessing as I stayed in the hospital with him almost every single night that he was there. They have the Siteman Cancer Center has a beautiful facility, and they set it up for family to be able to stay. And anyway, I looked at his heart monitor, and I could see everything was just crazy. And I called the nurse, and she called the cardiologist, and from 1 o'clock until 6 in the morning, the cardiologist never left the room, never moved from in front of my husband's heart monitor, trying to get his heart. He'd gone into severe AFib and just continually pushing blood pressure or whatever medication through his IV. And my husband was completely unconscious through all of it. He doesn't even remember it. But just watching that cardiologist, you know, they'd give him medicine, his heart rate would start to settle, and we'd think, okay, it's good. And then he'd go, nope, here we go again. And just watching that for hours. You know, that's one story of the things that he had gone through. So it was really quite an ordeal. But one of the things that friends and family and just different people we would encounter would say is, you know, you're so strong. You're so strong. You're handling this so well. And I would just, I would be so floored when they would say that. And I think for me, it was like, what choice do we have? You know, it's not that I'm strong. It's just that this is totally out of my control. And I, you know, if I've ever learned to not be a control freak, that was the time, because there was absolutely nothing that I could do, and we had to totally surrender all of it to God. From the very beginning of that journey, you know, for me praying that prayer for God to please heal my husband, and then, you know, within hours we're in the emergency room, and I just think back to God saying, I hear your prayer. You don't know what you're praying, but I know what you're praying, and I know what you need. And we're going to, here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to attack this. And, you know, from that moment on, God showed up for us in so many little ways and big ways that not a single time did we ever feel like we were alone. We knew that he was in control of everything. And just to give you a few very specific, quick examples. Those first couple of days that we were in the hospital, so we went in Wednesday and Thursday. I was going to go to school on Friday to get all my lesson plans ready for my kids and to go in and see my kids. And at that point, my last year and my last few years, I only taught 1 hour a day because I was actually a curriculum director and instructional coach, so most of my hours were office hours. But so I had this one group of seniors, and while I was in the hospital before I went to see them on Friday, I was just thinking about just the expense of what we were facing, and even just parking in the parking garage for every 24-hour period that I was in the parking garage, that was $15. And I'm thinking, we're going to be here for a month. You know, how am I going to afford parking, you know, which was a silly little thing to get caught up in, and which I later found out they did have a discounted parking program, but that's before I knew that. So just a silly thing to get caught up on is, how am I going to afford parking? So Friday, I walk into my classroom, and my kids are there and expectant, and they know everything that's going on, of course, and they hand me this big, fat envelope, and I'm like, what is this? And one of the boys says, well, we wanted to send you flowers, but we didn't think that would be very helpful, so we gave you this instead. And when I opened it, it was a card. It had $168 in it. And I had 25 kids from, you know, I just explained we're from one of the poorest counties in the state. And my kids hand me this envelope of $168, which, you know, and I just told them, I just started crying, and I said, okay, so while I was driving here today, you know, to come walk in this classroom, here's what was on my mind, you know. And, you know, and there's so much a part of me going, I can't take your money. You are children, and you know, I can't take your money, but I could not do that to them, because their faces were beaming. They were so proud of what they had done, you know. And so that was one example. And another example is my husband's first few days, he wouldn't get out of bed in the hospital. He was so depressed, and the doctors kept saying, you have to get up and walk, you have to keep your strength up, you have to, you know, every day you lay in the bed, you lose 30% of your muscle mass. And I think 30%, I don't think I'm making that up, I think that's right. But anyway, it was very important for him to walk. And finally one day I said, get up, put on this T-shirt, put on these shorts, we're going to walk the hall, you're getting exercise, we've got to get out of this room. And when we did, we happened to run into a gentleman who was he was 80, which was my husband's father's age when he had passed a couple of years prior. And his name was Joe, and he had a chemo pole that matched my husband's. You know, they were attached to their chemo pole 24/7. And Joe was an old farmer. He loved basketball. It was March, so March Madness was going on. My husband loved basketball. And Joe, as my husband says, Joe was his angel. And he and my husband struck up the best friendship for those 30 days we were in the hospital. And every day Joe came to visit and sit in Russ's room, and they would go out into the family lounge and on the big screen TV, watch college basketball, and it was funny because as the doctors would do their morning rounds, because the routine is the patients get their morning blood work, and then the doctors come in and talk about the blood work, what they're seeing with the treatments, what's going on. And Joe was in my husband's room so often in the mornings that the doctor did both of their rounds, both of their updates right there in front of each other. And Joe was always, he always wanted to know my husband's blood counts and what was going up and what was going down. He really, really made the difference for us during those 30 days. Another huge way that God showed up, where you go, this is only a God thing. It was one of the first days that I had left the hospital to go back to my classroom and get things ready so I could return to the hospital. A couple knocked on my husband's hospital room door and walked in and said, you don't know who we are, but this is our name. You know, this is who we are. This, you know, our names are this. And they had actually been in that hospital room. The man had been released the month before. He had spent 30 days in that hospital room. He had his bone marrow transplant in that room. And he saw my husband's name come across their church prayer requests, and his hospital room number was on that prayer request that went through the church. And that man saw that, and he had to come back to the hospital to just for his routine labs, and stopped in to see my husband and to tell him his story and to tell him, you're going to be okay, everything's going to be okay. And that was very early in our admission, and just something my husband really needed to hear. And it's just one thing after another throughout the entire, you know, several months of battling leukemia, that God just let us know, you are not alone. I'm surrounding you with my love through my people, and it's going to be okay, you know. And it was just, it's just been phenomenal. I've just got so many stories about how God showed up. And do we have time for one more?
Those are beautiful stories, Karen. And yes, I want to hear another one. Keep going.
Okay. So I, you know, as I explained, my husband, he did achieve remission after his first 30 days. And there are two roads you go. You achieve remission, or you get a bone marrow transplant, which you have to achieve remission to go to a bone marrow transplant, but there's got to be something that indicates you're not going to stay in remission. And that's what happened to us. We knew my husband was in remission, and we were very excited. But when we went back to visit the doctor for a routine lab, she saw the labs, and she said, you know what, I think we better go to bone marrow transplant. I don't think you're going to stay in remission for a year. She said, I think you're going to relapse within the year. So we were floored, just absolutely floored. And we knew after that visit, that was a Friday visit, that we would leave her office and go straight to the hospital because it was time for him to have another treatment. And so we get into his hospital room, and we're pretty much devastated because we thought we were going to get, again, air quotes here, the easy route. You know, we were going to do remission, you know, just go to remission. He had his 30 days of treatment, and then he would have 5 treatments afterward to keep him in remission. And so that's what we thought we were there for. But she informs us, no, we're going to go to bone marrow transplant. We're pretty devastated. And so we're there Friday and Saturday. Sunday, we're in the sunroom. They have a beautiful sunroom for the families. And we were watching our church service online. And service gets over, and a gentleman comes into a sunroom, and he's on a chemo pole, as most patients are. And there's a lady with him, and they come in, and they chat with each other just a little bit. And on his way out, he says something to us, and I can't even remember what. So we have a real quick exchange, and come to find out, he's having a bone marrow transplant the next day. And so immediately I'm like, can we pick your brain? You know, can we talk to you about this? And he's like, sure. So he sits down, and come to find out he's a Lutheran minister. And he is so full of joy, and he's telling us his story. And he prayed with us, and it, you know, everything we've been feeling that whole weekend was just immediately gone. Because, you know, God sent Ron to us. It's exactly how we felt. And then we were there that week while Ron went through his bone marrow transplant. So we got to watch the whole process. It was just, again, a moment of God saying, it's going to be okay. And we're still very, very good friends with Ron. We stayed in touch with him through, you know, both of our journeys. So that's the beginning of the bone marrow transplant. And so then we're coming up to the day of the transplant. And I had really had very much a confidence that we were going to be okay, and my husband was going to be okay, and I had assured him of that many, many times through the journey, because I would tell him, I prayed for you. That night, I laid my hand on your chest, and I prayed for you, and then all of this was set in motion. God is taking care of us. You are going to be okay. I just felt so confident in that. But we're facing the transplant, and my confidence just, I don't know what happened, but it was just shattered, because I knew that there was a percentage of that the transplant could be fatal. There's a small percentage that he would have the transplant and life would be great, and there was a large percentage that he'd have the transplant and he would be dealing with complications, you know, possibly for the rest of his life, which is where we are. But I just want to say also that my husband survived and he is surviving, and we deal with these complications, and we're totally okay with taking another medication for another thing because he has survived. So I'm not even going to complain about that. But I did know going in that there was the possibility that those types of complications could get so strong that it could be fatal. So I was just driving back. I had, again, been home to take care of things, and I'm driving back to the hospital and praying and tears, and I was just, I had Michael W. Smith's This Is How I Fight My Battles, is how we fight our battles. I had that song on repeat over and over and over on my, you know, 2-hour drive to the hospital, and just praying, just totally shook up and a little frustrated at myself, because I was, but I also kept saying, God, you know where I am, you know this is how I am, I'm sorry, but this is just where I am, and I know you've got this, but so I get to the hospital complex, and the parking garage for the cancer center is closed, which that has never happened. And they've got the cancer center just conveniently located, and everything is so perfect for the families to where I just go into the garage, I hit an elevator, I go up 2 floors to the lobby, then hit another elevator, and I'm straight to my husband's room. They've just got it so perfect. But that garage is closed. And I'm like, oh, great. So I've got to drive across the complex to the general parking garage where everybody, anybody who is any kind of patient at all at the hospital or seeing any of the doctors, that's where everybody parks. And it's ginormous and it's crowded. And I end up having to go to the very top floor because, of course, everybody's parking there with the cancer garage closed, which doesn't sound like that big of a deal, except I'm moving into my husband's hospital room for a month because that's how long we're going to be there, and I've got luggage and, you know, a case of water and pillows, and I mean, I'm loaded down with all this just junk that I've brought, and I've got a traipse across the parking or the whole campus with all of this stuff, and how am I going to do it, and blah blah blah. So I see an empty wheelchair, and I decide I'm going to put all my stuff in this wheelchair and wheel it. And please know that I'm feeling so guilty because I'm using a wheelchair for the wrong reason to transport luggage. So I've just got all these crazy emotions going on.
Of course. And I'm, goodness. Gee.
Yeah, and so I get to the elevators, and one is, it's open, but it's pretty full, and there's a guy holding the door for me, and he says, are you coming? And I look at the elevator and all my junk, and I'm like, no. And so he lets that elevator close, and the next elevator opens up, and there's only one person on it. And so I said, okay, you know, and I push this big old wheelchair full of stuff that I'm trying to keep from, you know, avalanching off the wheelchair, and I get on the elevator, and I push the button, and the gentleman just looks at me, and he said, are you okay? And I said, oh, I'm just a little bit crazy, you know, and he goes, yeah, me too. He said, I have to come here every 3 months for labs and to see my doctor. Well, that rang very familiar to me because I knew at some point my husband would have to come every 3 months for labs and to see his doctor. And so I just looked at him and I said, can I ask you why you're here? And he said, yeah, I had a bone marrow transplant 7 years ago for leukemia. And I said, you have got to be kidding me. If I had run into this man on the elevator in the cancer center parking garage, that would have been less miraculous.
Not so surprising. Yeah, exactly.
But that I'm in the main complex where anybody could be, and there's one man on the elevator, and this is what he says to me. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. I said, my husband is having his transplant tomorrow. Can I talk to you? And he said, sure. And so I just followed him. We get off the elevator. I'm pushing my big old wheelchair of junk, and I'm following him to his doctor's office, just asking him all these questions. And he's telling me about his experience. And he finally says, your husband is going to be fine. He really is going to be fine. And I said, thank you so much. And then I said to him, I said, I just have to tell you, I have been in such a bad emotional place, you know, these last several hours. And seeing you on the elevator, I said, this is a God thing. And he said, well, I will tell you it's a God thing because I don't talk to people on elevators, but I knew I was supposed to talk to you. And
that's fabulous.
Yeah, and so that, you know, that was just our journey. And as awful as it was, and there were times that were just, I just, the details were are just too ugh to even discuss. But at every turn, God picked us up. God reminded us that he was there. And, you know, and even now, been 2 years since my husband's transplant, he still hasn't been released to have lab work every 3 months and see the doctor every 3 months. We've been seeing the doctor every 4 to 6 weeks. He just, his next appointment is in 8 weeks. So we're getting to that place, hopefully, where he'll be well enough to where they don't have to monitor him as regularly. So it's been quite a journey. But we smile every day. We thank God every day. I would never want to do it again, ever, and I would never ask for it. But I also would not want to miss how God has been so real to us through the whole journey, and also the people, other patients that we were able to just surround with our love and compassion and empathy and walk through their journey with them, which was one of the most interesting things about the 8th and 9th floor, which is where these patients, whenever we were in the hospital, we were either on the 8th or the 9th floor, and you're back in all the time because you're either getting chemo or you have an infection, and now you're in because you're sick. And so we're always seeing the same people. But what was interesting is when you walk that floor, that hallway, and you pass a patient or a family member, there's no eye contact. People's heads are down. It's just like everybody is just so isolated. And I just kind of thought at one point, people, we are all going through the same thing. We can't do this. And so I just got to be very vocal, you know, and I would pass somebody in the hallway and or meet them in the little kitchenette and just start a conversation. And very quickly, people want that so much. And we needed it as well, just to make those connections. And then every day, hey, how are your blood counts? Hey, what's going on? What the doctor say? Are you getting released? Oh, this is great. You know, just constant. Are you're back in for a treatment or because you have an infection and you see somebody in the hospital again, you go, oh, what are you guys here for? Oh, we're here for treatment. Okay, good, good. Or, oh, we got an infection. You're like, oh, what's going on? You know. Just those conversations to journey through it together. And so we just made some very, very wonderful friends through that. And one of the things that always gives me perspective as well, there were a group of five of us, five families that got to be pretty close, and two are surviving. One is my husband, and one is the Lutheran minister, Ron, that I mentioned, that we met in the sunroom. So that gives us perspective. But, you know, we have definitely been blessed in this journey and where we are. And, you know, we know that it's very possible that any doctor's visit we make, any lab work could be lab work that would put a fork in our road and put us on a different path. Right now, we don't worry about that because God's got every day, and that's just how we walk this journey. So that's kind of our story.
And the way you told that story, Karen, you showed us all that you went through, and yet you didn't get real graphic with, like you said, some of the stuff that you wouldn't want to have to discuss. So I thought, you need to write it. You need to write that story, girl.
Well, I've written several versions of it for Guidepost.
Oh, good. Okay.
You know, I've been able to, Elevator Man was a devotion. I had to talk about my Elevator Man. And, just different, any of those ways, you know, all of those have been turned into different devotions for, mostly for strength and grace. So
and thank you for your perspective. Karen, thank you for your perspective, because it helps to hear how you are now and where you are now and how you're surviving now, because to say it's over isn't true. And so you still live with us and you still get your checkups and you still praise God and you still move forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I also want to say, as I can sit here with a smile and feel joy about our journey, you know, joy through the hard, I do want to also say, we are 2 out of 5 families and out of many families who did not have a survivor. Right. And I certainly don't want to discredit I can't say how I would be feeling and what this conversation would be like right now if my husband had not survived. I think I would have another version. I hope the version of the story that I told, that would still be true, but I'm pretty sure that I would have other things to say as well had my husband not survived. So I don't want to at all diminish or seem like I don't have compassion for people who have had this journey or a similar journey that ended differently, because my heart is very, very broken and compassionate for those families. As I said, I walked through breast cancer with my mom and taking care of my mom in her home and going through the journey that didn't end well. Ended well ultimately, eternally, but from an earthly perspective and from a daughter who lost a mom and that pain and that loss and that grief, you know, I do know that very well.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for sharing this journey with us, Karen, because it's got to be very difficult to go through it again. And, you know, I said write a book, but another thing I was told at another conference, influence 10,000 people with a book, but influence 100,000 people with a magazine. So you've probably done that with the several magazine articles that you have gleaned from this. So you probably took the right route in doing that, and I'm glad that you did pursue that and that you shared that experience with so many readers, Karen. That's a true blessing, and thank you. And thank you for sharing it with us and our listeners today.
Well, thank you so much. And again, I want to go back to when I was getting ready to retire, and I said, God's got something for me, and I don't know what it is, but I'm excited to see what it is. I just feel such a sense of responsibility / joy in being able to use what we've experienced and maybe encourage or bless somebody who is also walking through or has walked through, just to be able to have that connection however God may be using those stories. Just total humble thanks to Him that we've been able to do something more with it than just live through it, you know, but to maybe be able to use it to glorify Him in some way and encourage others.
Right. Absolutely.
Definitely, yeah. And it takes a lot to do that, so thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate your invitation.
Thanks, Karen. This was a wonderful show. Really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you, ladies, so very much. I appreciate you.
Well, God bless you, Karen, and may God continue to bless your husband's health, and we wish you the very, very best.
Well, thank you so very much, and you ladies have a blessed afternoon.
Listeners, in closing, we all encounter dark periods in our lives to one degree or another. During those difficult times, strive to seek the light, knowing that when we allow it to shine through, it is so much brighter than we remembered. Thank you for spending time with us today. Would like to remind you to go to pattysheene.com. That's pattisheene.com. There you will find a link to Karen's show if you'd like to listen to it again or refer it to others. Also, under each of the shows you will find tab, and that's where you will find Karen's website and her social media information, and the same with all of our other guests and our shows that we have recorded to date.
There is a candle in every soul, some brightly burning, some dark and cold. There is a spirit who brings a fire, ignites a